What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. And on the show today, we've got Tejas Menon.
What's up, everybody?
Kiara Mitchell.
Hello.
Hunter Marsden.
Hey, hey.
And Jake Dello.
What's up?
There we go. All right. Two quick hits, one on conservative foreign policy and one on Cambodia. The first one. This is a shout out to me, by the way. I have a piece just out in Duck of Minerva, and it's kind of a response to a lot of gaslighting that I'm seeing conservatives doing in their internal debates about foreign policy. So neocons are almost hegemonic in mainstream media and within conservative movement, at least. And they're saying on Wax, right, in foreignpolicy.com, the American Enterprise Institute, Daniel Pletka, right, neocon of neocon, they're saying that the debate within conservatism right now is pitting internationalists against isolationists. This is not true. This is what the neocons are saying, right? And then the New York Times had a piece that kind of presented the Heritage Foundation, another conservative think tank, as dovish, like as in no longer hawkish, no longer militarily aggressive. That's obviously not true either, right? So everybody is like misunderstanding or misrepresenting what's going on. And in the Duck of Minerva piece, I just lay out three different conservative camps, right? To make sense of the landscape, you have realpolitik restrainers, people like Patrick Porter, David Hendrickson, Chris Preble. You have straight up neocons, the AEIs, the John Boltons, the Corey Shockeys. These are the military primacists who basically support a liberal version of empire. They're a familiar adversary to those of us on the left, right? And then there's this other category, the emergent category, that is confusing people. And it's the nationalist militarists, right? And these are the Trumpists, or the ultra MAGA, as Biden liked to say the other day, on Russia and on nation building and on alliances. They sound a little restrainy, right? And that's where the misunderstanding is happening, because these guys are not just pursuing China rivalry, they are, but they're imposing a racist clash of civilizations filter on China rivalry, right? They're all about military primacy, just like the neocons, but they don't want any of the obligations that come with maintaining a position of primacy. And I just like, I can't imagine like something more dangerous than a worldview that wants the benefits of empire, but without any of like the maintenance responsibilities of empire. So A, these guys are really bad news, but B, the foreign policy project of these nationalist militarists, it's downstream of the new political configuration of the like new right, post-liberal right, whatever, like they're basically fascists. And so I mention this simply because a lot of people are making a category error in confusing nationalist militarists and restrainers, right? And you just cannot take on good faith what conservatives say about the conservative foreign policy debate. Oh, second quick hit. So there are reports that China's building a military facility in Cambodia. We've kind of been hearing about this since 2019. There was rumors about it even before that, actually. And there are new details now that are trickling out. This is Hunter's beat, so I'll turn to him in a second. But just two thoughts. One, Blake Herzinger, a friend of the pod, had the best take on this that I've seen from anyone. It just happened to take the form of a Twitter thread, and I'll try to link to that in the show notes. Two, like, we have a pretty gross history of fucking over Cambodia. We still hold debt over them that we are literally in the Biden era harassing them to repay, even though it was money that never went to the Cambodian people and in fact was siphoned by a prior illegitimate regime, right? In a legal sense, this is an odious debt. And in a fucking moral sense, it's odious that we would like continue to impose it on them. And the worst, like most self-defeating part is that it is the economic depravity that leads Hun Sen and the regime in Cambodia to turn to China, right? Like, it's no secret Cambodia is in the pocket of China. It's been this way for quite a while. But like, if we have a problem with that, why the fuck would we perpetuate a situation that forces them into that pocket further, right? So as ever, there is what I would see as like a liberal failure to think about root causes and to take seriously our role in making the circumstances that we dislike, that creates a world that we find threatening, right? There's more I could say about this, but do you have thoughts, Hunter?
Yeah, I've got some thoughts. I think you already sort of touched on some of them. So yeah, I would second your mentioning of Blake Herzinger's excellent Twitter thread here, which I think smashed it out of the park. So you're right. We've heard about this since at least 2019 from the Wall Street Journal reporting previously. There's not a ton that's new here. What was interesting to me in this report, which came out through Washington Post and some good investigative reporting, was sort of two things. And this is interestingly sort of on based on interviews from a CCP official who probably no longer has a job at this point, if he's alive or she. But the details that are now emerging make the base look a lot more credible. What we know now, according to this latest report, is that the base won't be exclusively China's, which is interesting. And so it'll be sort of an adjacent facility, and the Cambodians have knocked down some of the American-funded defense facilities that were already on site in Ream Naval Base. Mm. And as well, they've pushed out some of the Vietnamese friendship facilities. I forget the exact terminology used. But so it's interesting in that this shows that China's military presence here is not completely exclusive. But it does have exclusionary aspects to it in the fact that they've displaced the Vietnamese now. So this will have major security implications for the region and for other Southeast Asian countries. But it does fit into sort of this larger trend, which we've touched on recently, especially in light of the Solomon Islands and the sort of hysteria in the media around that and China's sort of encroaching security presence in the Pacific. And I think it's too soon to really freak out about this. It's not a new Chinese military base capable of projecting power just yet, right? We have to sort of wait and see. It certainly could be something along those lines. In 2019, I was a bit skeptical still. The satellite imagery lends a lot of credibility to these reports, but at this point, it looks a lot more real. The other thing I would mention is that China will use the facilities to expand its own global positioning satellite system. So that's separate from US GPS systems, and Russia has its own, forget what their satellite systems are called, but this will enhance China's own maritime domain awareness and satellite imagery capabilities in the South China Sea and in Southeast Asia. Cambodia might not be concerned about that, but other countries in Southeast Asia certainly are. And there's a reason that Hun Sen, the prime minister of Cambodia, has downplayed these reports, and Chinese and Cambodian officials are all denying this, because it is very unpopular in Cambodia. A lot of interesting strategic and security implications, and certainly testing Cambodia's diplomatic relationship with Beijing at this point.
Yeah, that was all fair. I mean, I guess the only thing I would add is that we have to keep some things in mind. Like, we have a much larger military presence in Southeast Asia than China. And even in recent years, we have still engaged in military cooperation with Cambodia. And it's understandable to securitize the construction of military bases, like to be wary that your rival, like from a national security perspective, is increasing their capabilities or their capacity. But we have to be aware of the hypocrisy in that too. Like, we need to keep a sense of proportion and self-awareness. Like, Thailand is right next door, and technically they're treaty allies with us. And it's bad analysis to exempt yourself from the lens that you impose on others, you know? And so the thing to look out for is what Hunter mentioned, insofar as we know it, which is like, how exclusionary are China's security arrangements? Because I look, the sane comparison is the Singapore example to me always. Love all, serve all, right? China and the US get to have military access to Singapore. This is a kind of hedging, right? And it's not fair to smaller nations to securitize the China part of their hedging strategies, right? And in Asia, it happens to be that what's not fair is also not smart and not strategic. So you should care about this stuff even if you're an amoralist, right? If you want to do good strategy.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, that's the other point I forgot to mention is, you know, the Singapore parallel. So anybody who's quick to jump on this and sort of point out, you know, China's rapidly expanding military presence in the region and exclusionary tactics should at least keep in mind that the United States military has had access through an MOU with Singapore to naval and basing facilities in Singapore since 1990, which was just renewed in 2019. Not to mention the other countries in the region in Guam that have troops on the ground and actual U.S. security presence there.
Yeah. Fair points. I was going to do a third quick hit, but on East Timor, but actually it's like very similar to the story we just talked about with Cambodia. The problem of it is the same. And we're sort of short on time. So we'll just go straight to the next segment.
Sages.
Apologies for before the power went out over here. It's crazy.
Oh, shit.
Really, really bad weather. but classic Wellington.
Yeah, we're in a storm as we record this in Wellington.
That's the thing. Cool. So for those of you who don't know or are new to the pod, this is a segment where we give three headlines to Ven. Two of them are real, one of them is fake, and we sort of challenge him to figure out which one is the fake one. So here are the headlines. The first one, Ryanair asks travelers to prove South African nationality in Afrikaans. The second one, Vietnam's health minister arrested for COVID test gouging. And third, Kendrick Lamar's new album has been banned in Russia due to Auntie Diaries, a song about trans acceptance.
Oh my God. These are all false, right? Wait, so one is true or two is true?
Two or three, one is false.
Oh my God. I'm going to say Kendrick Lamar's album being banned in Russia is false.
Nice. Good
job.
Is
it true? I mean, that's true that it's false.
Yeah. It's false. That's the false one.
All right.
That song did cause a lot of controversy for it being like a ham-fisted approach at being like a trans acceptance song. But it wasn't banned in Russia, at least not that I know of.
What was the controversy about it? I saw that there was something.
You know, I wouldn't be the right person to speak about it because it's not me being represented.
Sure.
But certainly a lot of the controversy has to do with the lack of care or effort being put into representing what trans people go through in that song. Mm. It's sort of his perspective on what the challenges are instead of, and it shows a lack of actual research and talking to people who've lived that experience is what people are saying.
So is it the trans community that's upset about the song, or is it some other?
Yeah. It's divided a lot of people in the LGBTQ+ community. So some people are for it, some people are against it.
I could probably, there's someone who's non-binary, experiences quite vary a lot in the trans community and can differ. Even within the general queer community, it varies, but I haven't listened to it personally, so I can't really comment. But if you hadn't really communicated with the trans community, I could see a lot of issues happening there, especially in the era of TERFs and trans exclusionary.
TERF was actually a term I had not even heard until recently.
Yeah. Example of a prominent TERF, J.K. Rowling.
Right. Somebody called her the white woman's Kanye West. Which is like
the white feminist anti-trans TERF movement. Very exclusionary practices and not good.
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't live in the US. I'm glad I live in New Zealand.
Must be.
Well, this is not the last. We have we got an AMA question on this as well, sort of coming up later in the show. But yeah, thanks to me for getting this question right.
Yeah. Smashed it.
All right.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
All right. First tweet from Kelsey Atherton, friend of the pod. He's responding to somebody else's tweet. So the original tweet is from this guy, Chris Fryman. I don't know. He says, public libraries aren't actually a socialist success story. The truly progressive position is to privatize libraries, run them on a subscription basis, and transfer the spared tax money to the poor, who could then spend it on a subscription if they preferred that to all other uses. So Kelsey Atherton says to this comically, for someone with no understanding of what socialism is, I admire your commitment to being publicly owned. I laughed out loud when I saw this. It's very funny. Obviously, this guy's out of his depth. The thing I would say about public libraries, which is obviously not like a podcast topic normally, is that like in the US in particular, it's hard to imagine what kind of society you could actually claim exists that makes America America if you were to like separate out the public library. Like when I was growing up, they were this core associational site that you go to for resources, for knowledge, particularly if you're in the bottom half of the income ladder, which I was, right? And like I found out later in life that it's the public library is a de facto place where a lot of homeless people are able to get emails, check emails, communicate with people to the extent that you're plugged into the matrix to like pay bills, right? If you have a phone or something. It's a place where you can go to the bathroom, which sounds like a small thing, but in America, everything's fucking privately owned, and it's actually hard to find a public restroom a lot of times. Like, you can't go to a Starbucks and use the bathroom unless you're a paying customer, right? Which is kind of a problem if you don't have a place to live. So, like, public libraries have become part of a kind of social safety net, but they're also a little bit of a glue for society. You know, like they're just so multi-use. And then like small side story, when I was, I don't know if I've ever said this before, but when I was in like middle school or early high school, I had started getting obsessed with Tupac. And so I was looking for a biography on Tupac or something at the public library. And my first exposure to like black radicalism was, a biography called Asada that had nothing at all to do with Tupac, but I mistakenly opted into it thinking that it was about Tupac's mom. And then it ended up introducing me to like a memoir of black radicalism that doesn't explain anything about me, I don't think, but it's an interesting just like anecdote that would not have happened if it wasn't for the public library, you know. Shout outs to public libraries. That's all I got to say about that. Second tweet from Adam Mahoney. He says, the most gut-wrenching part of the last 2 years is definitely the lost lives. But as a young person, it feels even more demoralizing because we have learned so few lessons. We could have restructured our entire world and our relationships with each other, and we didn't do it. And this is kind of like a depressing vibey thing, but it strikes me as true. And at an analytical level, like on an emotional level, at an analytical level, this is like why the aliens will defeat us, right? Like, this is why we can't collective action ourselves to literally save our own lives. Like, what could be more of a rupture than having to literally like stop daily life, to like de-associate physically, and then to expose large numbers of people to higher risk of sickness and death, to expose everybody to higher risk of sickness and death, but then to like expose large numbers of people to actual death, right? There was a chance here to do something on behalf of our own humanity, and we fucking failed the test. you know? So next time when the challenge is bigger, there's no reason to think that we're going to meet it. And that's fucking really depressing, you know? Right, Jake, are you there?
Howdy, folks. I hope I'm here in real time.
All right.
New Zealand internet is notoriously bad, so I apologize if I'm all over the place, guys.
You sound good.
So, and this, dear listeners, is why live shows are not in our purview, it seems. All right, so I'm taking over for Gabby today, stay off Twitter, and I've got two. First one is from Buffy the Psych Professor, and she says, I've been a college professor for over 20 years. In all those years, there's really been a semester where my conservative students weren't the most dominant voice in the classroom. They're not afraid to speak. They're just mad that they get pushback now when they do.
Yeah.
So how do we feel about that, dudes?
That's my sense, too. It's not, I don't know if it's a partisan thing or not, this, like, being super vocal in class. I think it may be just be, like, a personality thing. But every class I've had has had a conservative in it, and they've not been afraid to make that known. Maybe there are some conservatives in the class and like I don't know about, but there's always a conservative who is, you know, reactionary and proud and not, you know, like they're going to be transgressive a little bit and edgy, and that's our problem. Like that's kind of the attitude. And it's not like, especially in New Zealand, it's not super disruptive so far, knock on wood. But I don't sense that like being sort of like politically conscious or, you know, I hate the term woke, but like being progressive in any sense, like being in a progressive environment, it's hard to see how that's oppressive. I don't buy it almost, you know, like, so I'm trying to be sympathetic to people who are not like me. But it's real. The reasoning that makes you feel oppressed is sketchy. Like I question it.
Cool. Just as an add-on, I heard this. This thing that in a group setting, even if the split is 50-50, or you know, cisgendered men only comprise of 50% or even lesser, or more, they feel that their voices aren't heard. Even if the split is 50-50, just because they're so used to dominating the conversation all the time.
So, like, it's all about expectations then.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I did not have
college experience. So I wonder where this professor teaches. I went to a very liberal arts school, though, small school, where I think conservatives were in the minority. And this was during the Bush years and the Iraq war. So people were really, you know, having active political debates. But for the most part, we were all sort of, you know, like-minded, progressive young college students.
As someone who's gender non-conforming, I could speak on many experiences I've had at university and sometimes in classes with conservative people or people who don't like gender non-conforming people or gender diverse people or even queer people. The amount of times of being misgendered by lecturers as well, by professors, I've had that, and sometimes maliciously. And I've gotten a tagline in my email, my pronouns. I've had people purposely use them wrong quite a few times. And then just the comments from other students in class, hence why I've started doing my stuff online, because sometimes I don't feel safe in the lecture theater.
So do you think that people conforming to your gender pronouns oppresses them, though? I mean, like, that's the conservative argument. Like,
no, it does not.
Does your security come at their expense? I mean, like, that's the part that I can't wrap my mind around.
Such an inconvenience to them. Like, they have to think about
this. It's not going to even oppress them at all. It's like it's they, them. It's not hard.
There's something in the DNA here on the reactionary side of this that's like in the same vibe as like Jews will not replace us. It's like this if I'm less than dominating, then there's a discrimination problem against me. Yeah.
Yeah, I always think of this great SNL skit, Thanksgiving dinner, where one of the old, you know, racist or transphobic parents says something like, you know, back in my day, we didn't have trans. you know, it wasn't a thing. And someone snaps and says that's because they weren't recognized. They lived lonely lives, you know. And I think that really says a lot about the current moment, right?
Yeah.
You know,
I've had those conversations. To recognize or
not. You denied their existence is why it wasn't a thing. Right. Yeah.
It's like they existed. You just don't want to recognize it.
The conservative reaction really is conservative in the literal sense, right? They want to preserve the old ways, and there were simple categories, and they don't want to adapt. They don't want to change that way of thinking. And, you know, to them, I guess it is a threat to their identity in some sense.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes you find it's not always conservative. It's sometimes people who don't understand the queer community that will say that stuff.
Mm.
And it's harmful saying that. We exist, we've always existed, and there's historical accounts of our existences. You just refuse to acknowledge it.
This is one of the things that's worrying about the Red-Brown Alliance stuff, because it's the way that the right is morphing, they're kind of trying to bait the left into giving up on minority and marginalized communities in the name of like higher minimum wage or something, and like that's the bargain. It's a losing cause for the left. So did Jake just cut out again?
I was just gonna say I'm not usually one to take the position of conservative defense, but I think it is important to remember that anti-trans and anti-LGBT, and there isn't a conservative principle. You know, I've met many conservatives that are just fiscally conservative and quite socially progressive. You know, we have to distinguish reactionary, you know, dangerous thinking like MAGA Trumpism from conservatism that actually has some points, you know, and there are valid conversations to be had, and we can't always reduce them the same way they reduce us to SJWs, you know, all those things.
Well, I don't know what's going on in the rest of Wellington, but where I'm at, we're in the middle of like a fucking tornado or something, just so people are aware. I don't know, this is fucking going crazy while we're recording.
Yeah.
All right. Shit, like the lighting is changing in here. Oh my God.
It's the apocalypse, man.
All right.
It's good I'm in Wellington.
That was here just like a few minutes ago, and I guess it's going up the coast.
Oh shit. Yeah. I mean, like,
probably come to me later.
There's shit flying by my window. Like, it's all right.
It was crazy.
Let's do that second tweet before this whole thing collapses.
little do the listeners know that we actually set this up to happen in response to the question about live shows.
There we go.
All right, listeners, here's a tweet by JP Brousseau. It's in meme format. And I'm going to make myself a bit of a meme trying to read this out, but here we go. You, a rube. Biden has torn up strategic ambiguity, whereas me, an intellectual, accidentally giving Taiwan a security guarantee multiple times only to have it walked back by senior aides is a perfect execution of strategic ambiguity. Boom, meme-tastic. What do we think about that, guys?
That was you did a good job reading that for how hard it is to read memes. So strategic... strategic ambiguity about Taiwan and whether America would defend Taiwan if attacked, that has not changed, you know? And strategic ambiguity about just, like, navigating Chinese-Taiwan relations... The problem is that it's done in like kind of a ham-fisted way. So Biden goes out and makes statements that sound like they're changing the status quo. And then his staff have to walk it back. And that's a bad look, right? Somebody lower on the hierarchy walking back the highest person on the hierarchy. But there's like a couple of things to note here. One, this has happened under every presidency. Every single president that I know of, like I can think specifically of Trump, Bush, and Obama, said something that was fucking ahead of their skis on Taiwan. And then the staff tried to sort of walk it back. So like the ambiguity of confusion and the ambiguity of like incompetent kind of look, that is as it ever was. And so to the extent that ambiguity is like uncertainty due to incompetence, that applies as much to Biden as it does to previous presidents. Bush was like really notorious for this. But two, like even Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail last year, people forget this shit 2 years ago now. People forget. He said specifically on 60 Minutes that we would defend Taiwan militarily if attacked, right, by China. So like if China was the naked aggressor, there really isn't ambiguity about that. The thing that's ambiguous is like we're not going to chest thump about it. We're not going to make – we don't need to make deterrent threats. Like we don't need to change how we talk about any of this stuff, you know. So the ambiguity is as it ever was, whether it's competent or incompetent. I mean, that's maybe up for debate, but the ambiguity is does not deny the fact that like we constantly reaffirm that if there's naked aggression against Taiwan, we'll defend them. There's really just a question of what defense means at that point, which can look like many different things, you know. So that's up in the air. It's interesting. I don't know. Interesting topic.
Yeah. The other ironic point here is that Biden himself penned an op-ed to criticize George Bush when he made a similar gaffe back in 2002.
Yeah.
So
it's not like Joe Biden.
One of my takeaways here is that, you know, I think you have to be able to hold a couple different paradoxical facts in mind here. That, you know, one, it could be a gaffe, but at the same time, he probably meant what he said, right?
Yeah.
One thing I've heard about the way Biden's foreign policy has been run and his team has had to adapt to this is basically he says stuff and that becomes the policy and they have to run with it. But yeah, I don't see how this has killed the era of strategic ambiguity. I think, you know, Beijing is probably scratching their heads just as much as China, Taiwan analysts in the US and elsewhere are.
Yeah, yeah, fair point.
For this week's Armchair Analysis, we have an article in the New York Times by Peter Beinart. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think it's Beinart, but yeah, whatever.
Beinart. I've read his stuff for a long time, never say his name out loud, oddly enough. The title of the article is Biden's Foreign Policy Team the Best of the quote-unquote blob? So it's, you know, it's not a new argument to be made that the Biden administration really represents some of this DC blob, the establishment, right? A lot of the familiar faces in the Biden administration were also key players in the Obama team years before. So we have Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, Kirk Campbell, the Asia Czar, DNI Avril Haines, CIA Director Bill Burns. A lot of these people worked together before.
Yeah.
And the problem with having so many familiar faces and those in the ideological flow of one another, I suppose, is that familiarity breeds groupthink. So I've got no quibbles there. You know, Beinart is absolutely correct. That is a major problem and presents certain blinders for the team. The piece even has a quote from Ben Rhodes, who's, you know, Mr. Blob, the guy who sort of coined this term, you know, now looking somewhat critically from afar at the Biden team. You know, he was instrumental in the Obama White House.
Yeah.
So Beinart writes that the blob tends to see American foreign policy as a series of military challenges which require military solutions. Personally, you know, I've got no major disagreement there, but I don't think that's the major criticism that folks have of the blob. I think the sort of perceived fault of the blob is that it's sort of this elite group that's unelected and unaccountable, right? They strike free trade deals, which overlook sort of the blue collar workers and go about global policy without again, any accountability, but I don't think it's sort of the criticism generally isn't restricted to these folks are militarists. So that's a bit of a strange angle in my mind as I read this piece. And you know, my beef with it, I think, if I can just sort of try to think this through out loud, is that he defines the problem as the way Washington views its adversaries. But he sort of shifts all the blame onto the US foreign policy machinery without acknowledging, I think, what the adversaries are doing in the first place. So, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine, right? Now, this piece is a little bit critical of the fact that the Biden administration is, quote unquote, trying to bring or hobble its adversary, bring Russia to its knees, right? I mean, we can debate the strategic merits of Biden's Russia policy in response to the Ukraine invasion. But I think the author is going a bit soft on, you know, the adversaries as first movers in some sense here. And that's not to really say this applies equally to China, right? I think that some of the fault lines and strategic frictions in the US-China relationship predate the Biden administration. You can't really say this is something that the Biden team has done. But my point is, it's not like the Biden team just came into power and is hawkish just for the sake of being hawkish. I mean, there is some of that. I'm sure, Van, you have many more thoughts here. But I don't think I've really made much coherence here. But the piece ends from Mahbubani, or a quote from Mahbubani, who's a Singaporean thinker who's really just kind of a talking head for Beijing at this point. And I thought this piece was a little bit ludicrous in the fact that it didn't really explore the counter argument here, which I'd like to at least acknowledge.
So what's funny about this piece is that Beinart's very hit and miss. This piece is a good example of this. Like, I thought it was like a pretty lazy and like unpersuasively argued piece, but I also thought the thrust of it was basically correct. And so, like, I've said many times, like, I don't love the term blob, partly because of the imprecision of like what it's taken to refer to, you know. Having said that, the Biden administration, like, of course, gives off a lot of blobby energy, right? And I think the trap is responding to that with like lazy critique. Like, if you're going to be out of power, you got to be on your game analytically, you know, and the trap is to sort of fall into like a lazy criticism. So there are real problems in this administration that the piece kind of grazes by or like touches on, but then doesn't go in hard on. And so, like, the real corruption is a real story that people have sort of started to tell, but not really, right? Between the defense industrial complex having paid off a lot of these people that are serving in Biden's national security apparatus, right? Including people I would have called a friend a year ago, including people named in the piece. Groupthink is a big problem in this group too, right? But I think groupthink is actually a pathology that's downstream of a lack of intellectual diversity, right? So with the exception of one or two people, everybody in this administration is a liberal, and not just a liberal, but like they're the liberal in the specifically like unipolar sense, right? They have not updated, again, except for one or two people, they've not updated their priors since the Obama era. And their commitments are not really to like clear concepts so much as like buzzwords and rhetoric about the ally liberal international order and images of America's place in the world that are like, they're not fully accurate to history and they're not faithful to current trends either. They're like incongruous with current trends. So like the piece, not so great. I kind of agree with some of those critiques, you know. Hunter's critiques. It's just that these people working for Biden, again, some of whom are my friends, like they have the best and the brightest problem. They're individually very smart, but they are less than the sum of their parts, you know? And that's really damning. The issue really though is like when you make this kind of argument, you gotta come hard with the data. So like Robert Jervis had a article in Security Studies right before he died recently. And so I think it was like 2020 or 2021. And he was arguing that Stephen Walt's criticisms of the blob have a lot of promise, but not a lot of analytical merit so far. And like he laid out a challenge, like if you're going to criticize, if you're going to link foreign policy outcomes, like we see lots of bad foreign policy outcomes that we don't like, right, from the US. if you're going to link those causally to the composition of the foreign policy mandarins themselves, the elites themselves, you need to have like standards of evidence and like what's the sort of research design that's going to like show that causality. And we're at a point now where like we should be trying to make those linkages tighter. There actually is a lot at stake. And as a prima facie thing, like there is enough sort of like face validity to this claim that the blob or like elite unaccountability is culpable for disastrous foreign policy outcomes. But like now let's do the legwork and kind of show that. And this piece totally didn't go there. You know, this is like a 1,000-word op-ed, you know, a lot, almost stream of consciousness, you know, like throwing in stuff that seemed a little orthogonal or askew, and then like linking it to the blob very loosely. So like, I don't know, it was a good food for thought piece, but like mixed feelings overall.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Jervis and some more analytical rigor, which could be brought here to this field. You know, perhaps the foreign policy analysis lens would also be useful. But what are the data points you're looking for exactly? How do you find groupthink? And, you know, I guess what's the sort of dispositive there? You know, the absence of groupthink would be discrepancies, but it could be that, you know, they do a good job of keeping the disagreements within house rather than letting them sort of get out in leaks. But anecdotally, you know, when it was, I think, 2 weeks ago that the IPEF, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, emerged, I had read somewhere that part of the reason this has come out as such a hodgepodge of, you know, various components of economic framework or policy, and it's not a free trade deal, but, you know, the media's sort of captured it as such, is that there are large disagreements within the Biden team about how the U.S. should engage Asia with economic strategy. So you have Kurt Campbell, who was one of the big proponents of TPP previously in the Obama administration. And then you have Jake Sullivan, who's a lot more focused on domestic politics and realizes that a free trade deal would be disastrous and politically very unpopular for the Biden team. And some of those disagreements led to sort of the lowest common denominator, which is this watered down framework, which I know Van has touched on a lot with media commentary lately and in our own podcast discussions. But, you know, if that's just one illustration of the way disagreements are managed more or less peaceably within this White House, you know, I think it's worth at least exploring where those frictions might pop up rather than just saying these are all group thinkers because they were all on the Obama team previously and they're all liberals, so therefore they must think identically.
Yeah, so like there is groupthink going on, but if you try to like make that the ground that you make claims on and defend, you're actually losing a lot because like there's a lot more problematic shit going on than just what we would think of as groupthink. You're getting at it a little bit with the Indo-Pacific, like the lack of an economic perspective or the lack of economic statecraft. We can't do justice to it on the podcast, I guess, but there is the Bob Jervis thing really flagged how, or identified how like this deserves its own like research project or research program. Like American foreign policy is consequential enough and large enough and it touches enough things that we should be able to like dissect this, or it's worth spending time and money doing that. So yeah, like it's a bigger thing than I don't want to deny that groupthink is going on or distract from that, but like it's the Beinart type of criticisms obsess about groupthink as like the rhetorical thing that you point to all the time. And it's like groupthink is a kind of pathology, but that doesn't mean that that's the only kind of problem, you know? And it's sort of separate or distinct from problems of accountability generally, or like elite impunity, you know? Those are, that may well be a bigger problem. So what's the claim? What's the outcome that you don't like? And then how do you situate that relative to your claimed cause, you know? Yeah. All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
The first one is from a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Regarding your tweet about a progressive global order, could you outline what you're envisioning? Where does a place like Rand fit into your utopia?
I don't remember what tweet this is referring to.
From May 18th.
Jeez. So. Yeah, I don't remember. What I will say is that I have a research thing that's coming out very soon about progressive grand strategies. And I am incidentally giving a talk at Rand next week about it. So like maybe that's where this is sort of being triggered from. But there's different configurations of what like a progressive foreign policy would look like, or a progressive global order, right? Certainly more egalitarian and less sort of rhetorically hypocritical than the liberal international order. But it wouldn't be a complete destruction of the world that we know either. The thing to say about like where a place like Rand is a very technocratic institution, right? It's analytical and rational and methodsy, and clearly like militarist by tradition, by like by tendency, by funding, however you want to slice it. I would say that there's a version of a progressive global order that tries to do away with the national security state like entirely. And there's a version of the progressive global order that requires repurposing the national security state. So like this layer of what would be like the PMC, the professional managerial class, that's basically what the technocrats are, you know? The PMC is still necessary in a more democratic, egalitarian, and stable, peaceful world, right? Because progressive policies still require that like Mandarin proficiency. I don't mean fucking Chinese. I mean like the technocratic know-how, right? You need people to design and implement and manage complex systems and complex policies that skew favorably toward progressive outcomes, right? So like to achieve redistribution in a world where politics constantly fights against redistribution, or actually more precisely, a world where redistribution only goes upward, like it only concentrates at the top, right? To fix that and to challenge that is going to require extreme technical savvy, extreme competence in policy, and probably large numbers of people to do it. So you're still going to need institutions like the Rand Corporation, in my view. You're still going to need a thick layer of staff serving secretaries of state and defense, et cetera. Like the PMC national security state needs to exist in a progressive global order, I think, in my version of it. But the ends to which they work, the imagination, their policy horizon, the things that they're trying to achieve, the way they go about it, like the analytical foundations of their analysis just has to be very different than what it is currently, which is all about the state and power accumulation and these like this rhetorical line drawing around liberal international order, et cetera. So like incomplete answer for now, but there's some people who have a vision for like a progressive global order where there is no, there is no PMC. I think there is a PMC, and Rand is part of the PMC. It's just repurposing our technocratic know-how for like more egalitarian ends, if that makes sense.
The second question I have is from Benjamin Engel on Twitter. While discussing US-China policy on the most recent pod, Ben said something to the extent that the US shit the bed on Hong Kong. Not that I disagree, but would like to hear him expand a bit. What should the US be doing on human rights issues in China?
Yeah, it's a good question, Ben Engel, friend of the pod. So we shit the bed on Hong Kong because Trump literally gave the green light to Xi Jinping personally to take Hong Kong by force if necessary. Like he literally approved of the protests publicly, or of the suppression of the protests, sorry, in 2019 and 2020. And Trump literally gave the approval to Xi Jinping for mass internment of Muslim Uyghurs, right? And those things are fucked up. But you cannot even put it all on Trump, because we sided with China against the Uyghurs as part of the war on terror going back to 2001. And so when my Pacific Power Paradox book comes out at the end of this year, January next year, you'll see almost everything about Trump that we find to be wrong or stupid or evil on foreign policy, it already existed in Bush foreign policy and in Reagan foreign policy, and sometimes in Democratic foreign policy too. And the Trump betrayal of the Uyghurs and then turning them into a pawn and trying to act like it's the opposite with your like outrage about Chinese human rights, that is part of the historical pattern that didn't just like come up suddenly under Trump, right? But on the China human rights question generally, the false frame is to separate human rights from security, right? The false frame, I feel like we did a piece on this a while back. The false frame is to focus narrowly on human rights, like to put it in a box and then be like, okay, what ought to be done about the thing in that box that we call human rights abuses, right? Because you're not going to go to war over human rights, A. And then B, the answer about what to do about human rights depends totally on your diagnosis of why human rights abuses are happening. And that's the place that a lot of liberals don't want to go with their analysis and their prescriptions. Like the liberals I know, they want to present human rights as the alternative to some amoral, pragmatic national security as if it's a trade-off. And when you say the words national security, it fucking shuts down the conversation because obviously that trumps everything, right? But that's all a construction, right? You sanction human rights abusers in a targeted way, but that's no kind of solution, obviously, right? The solution comes from policies that weaken ethno-nationalism and oligarchies and kleptocracy, and that requires full-fledged campaigns for debt relief, right? For redirecting capital investment strategically, possibly through a very enlightened industrial policy, right? That requires campaigns for worker rights, minimum wage and minimum tax regimes. This is what I'm from the last question, right? The PMC. You need a PMC to do all that shit. Politicians can't do that stuff themselves. They can't figure out what that looks like. What do those campaigns look like, right? That's some nuts and bolts shit. You need technocrats for that. But the technocrats who are currently in power do not have it within their imagination to do these kinds of things. But these are the kinds of things. These are the solutions that respond to the economic insecurity and the extreme concentrations of wealth and power in societies where human rights abuses happen, right? So for like human rights, the technocratic answers are only going to be as good as the diagnosis, which is only going to come from a larger perspective, you know? So the answer to human rights is foremost, do not stick it in a box and then pose it as a trade-off to national security. To do that is to show that you actually don't understand world politics. And you are not to be trusted with international security, in my mind.
Any comments from anyone? Otherwise, I'll move on and get through. Okay, I'll move on to the third question from Dave Tizera. I think, is that correct surname pronunciation?
I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm just going to guess it's Tizera. To what extent is the East Asian peace threatened by dam construction, especially but not only on the Mekong, sorry. My brain is gone. My brain just...
No worries. I actually don't fully grasp the question, if I'm being honest. It's not a dodge. The question is asking, if you phrase it differently, to what extent are states in Asia willing to go to war over blocking water flows via the construction of a dam? I'm not sure I see that. That strikes me as less of a basis to go to war than, for example, arms racing or even military base building, even though I'm not particularly alarmed about that either. So it's not that you can't have issue conflicts, especially over like water scarcity. Like that can certainly happen. And actually that has been an recurring issue in the Mekong, but war, I don't know. I don't know. Do you have thoughts on this, Hunter?
A bit. You know, I'm really not a Mekong expert. Sadly, you know, the Stimson Center and Brian Ayler in particular do great work on this, on the Mekong generally. They actually have a very useful website called the Mekong Tracker, I believe it's called. And you can zoom in on all sorts of different projects and infrastructure going on the Mekong, around the Mekong, and see who's funding it and the nature of the project, the status of the project. Great stuff. You know, I'll just say, I think we discount the Mekong at our own risk, particularly in Washington and other capitals that are trying to get in the game in Southeast Asia and maintain influence and friendships. Because, you know, when you do travel to Southeast Asian capitals, a lot of these, a lot of strategic thinkers in those countries will say, yeah, the South China Sea matters, but, you know, the real competition is going on the Mekong now. And actually, China can quite literally shut off the valve and turn off the tap for downstream waters for Vietnam, which really do feed the country in terms of rice output and fish coming downstream. So it's a major concern, and it has strategic implications for food security and all sorts of livelihoods. But whether it leads to war, I'm not really sure. There's only so much that outside players can do to sort of mitigate those risks, especially when the Thais and Vietnamese are also building dams in these countries as well. So it's not just a Chinese game, right?
Yeah.
But what are we going to do? Are we going to come in and sort of build, I guess, the alternative would be to build smart energy systems that don't rely on hydroelectricity. But, you know, nuclear has its own sort of downsides in these countries. And unfortunately, coal is still a big portion of energy generation in Southeast Asia. So I think that there's more that could be done to fund alternate energy sources, renewable energies. But, you know, for better or worse, a lot of Southeast Asian countries on the Mekong are relying on hydroelectric dams. Hopefully it doesn't lead to war, but, you know, wars have been fought over sillier things, I suppose.
Yeah. At that point, though, you're just talking about, like, the logic of what's possible. Like, how many – we could make a long list of objects of conflict, or, like, objects that would prove as the site of, like, an irreducible conflict of interests, right, which is the basis for war. And it's like, it's not – somebody has to pay attention to each of the issues on that very, 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 very long list. But the idea that you're going to cherry pick any given one of them or set of them is not analytically useful. Like, at some point you have to entertain sort of like priorities, trade-offs, probabilistic thinking. The idea that like China's going to cut off another country from its basic energy supply, that's like launching a cyber attack against their entire energy infrastructure, which is the kind of thing that they could have done, that we could have done, that others could have done, but that doesn't happen because it's strategically consequential. Any move that's strategically consequential invites strategic consequences, including retaliation. So it's like, if you're going to do something that has the destructive power of a nuclear bomb, but it doesn't involve a nuclear bomb, it's going to invite those kinds of action-reaction consequences. And therefore, deterrence still applies. And like fear of over, like of producing negative feedback or like overreaching, that's still, that there's a reasonable basis to think that like rationality prevents you from doing that. Could conflict still happen in any particular space, like over hydroelectric, like withholding hydroelectric electricity or whatever? Maybe. But like, I'm not losing sleep over it, you know?
I'll ask the fourth question. So the fourth question is from me. And because it's Pride Month, I decided to ask, put it in. How do we factor LGBTQIA plus rights when looking at strategic foreign policy in relation to the Asia Pacific, where in some places it is still illegal to be part of the LGBTQIA plus community? So,
yeah, okay. So this is a heavy question to sign off with, but I do have a couple thoughts on this. I'm certainly not the authority though. Like, one, LGBTQIA plus rights are human rights, okay? Like we said a few minutes ago, it's a trap to deal with human rights as something that's distinct from everything else going on in foreign policy, right? The protection of human rights comes from a genuine human security. And I don't mean human security in just like the way that the literature refers to like the phrase human security, right? Economic security is necessary for human security. Like, you can't have a human security that like stops once you start getting to questions of like economic access or economic justice, right? It's like social justice minus economic justice is a problem. That's a trap. That's not justice, right? Two, it's important not to fall into the trap of what Olufemi Taiwo calls elite capture. So he's got a book that's just out about this. We're talking about getting him on the pod, actually, to talk about it. But when he talks about elite capture, he's kind of talking about like the neoliberal seizure of identity politics, like the woke part of woke capital or something. Our goal cannot be a ruling class that's 30% black or 20% LGBTQ, or that has gender parity. Why can that not be our goal? Because our goal cannot be to have a fucking ruling class, right? If you're being oppressed, do you care about the identity categories of your oppressor, or do you care about the oppression and the fact of it and how you're being oppressed, right? I would submit that the latter is probably the thing that is the issue. And a politics of deference and inclusion is important. It's like a starting point, though, right? It's a sign of progress, but it cannot be the horizon of your progress. Otherwise, there's a risk of being sold out, right? There's a risk that you'll include somebody on the grounds that their identity category is somebody that you want to include, but then that person doesn't represent the interests of that community. Right. Think about like Obama versus the black community. Right. So like we have to always ask, is the person that we want to include on the grounds of like diversity, is that person going to be a good advocate for the community that we're hoping they will represent? And the best advocate, it may not come from that community. Right. And if you think differently, you're risking getting the weird shit like the feminist peace theory that made the case for Hillary Clinton's presidency, even though she was a war hawk, right? Wildly militarist in her foreign policy preferences. And because it's not enough to think of identities as fixed categories, right? They're relational, they're fluid, they're processual. Three, related to the second point, from an analytical perspective, there is some queer IR theory. It's not very prominent, and like I'm not fluent in it, to be honest. But the move that I see in the academy is to subordinate LGBTQIA plus perspectives to feminist perspectives because it's gendered. And so it's like, well, if it's gendered, then that's enough, right? And like, I'll say again, this is not my area of expertise, right? But my sense is that LGBTQIA plus is a marginal category that's excluded from certain kinds of equality. And that makes it sort of like have higher affinity with post-colonial and like third worldist literature. And like that might be a better or like fairer analytical foundation for their perspectives. But like, I don't have firm views on this. And to be totally honest, I'm speaking out of my depth, but I was asked, so trying to answer. I don't know. That's kind of all I got. Those are like my preliminary thoughts. Hopefully I didn't go Kendrick Lamar on this. I don't know. All right, gang. Well, that's going to do it. Buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to buy us coffees. We're on YouTube. I think search Undiplomatic Podcast. I don't know what the URL is. And then cottonbureau.com. Search for Undiplomatic for the merch. Catch you next time. Sorry about the weather interference. Peace.